Disc 2.
Chapter 4. In the conference room of the OCME, Scarpetta rolls out a chair at the foot of the table, an outer reach of her former empire that she never visited when she was here. Not once did she sit at the foot of the conference table in the years she ran this office, not even if it was to have a casual conversation over a bagged lunch. It registers somewhere in her disturbed thoughts that she is being contraire by choosing a chair at the foot of the long, dark, polished table when there are two other empty seats midway. Marino finds a chair against the wall and sets it next to hers, so he is neither at the foot of the table nor against the wall, but somewhere in between, a big, grumpy lump in black cargo pants and an LAPD baseball cap. He leans close to her and whispers,
"Staff hates his guts."
She doesn't respond, and concludes that his source is Julie, the clerk. Then he jots something on a notepad and shoves it toward her. "FBI involved," she reads. Marino must have made phone calls while Scarpetta was with Dr. Marcus in the library. She is baffled. Julie Paulson's death is not federal jurisdiction. At the moment, it's not even a crime, because there is no cause or manner of death, only suspicion and sticky politics. She subtly pushes the notepad back in Marino's direction and senses Dr. Marcus is watching them. For an instant, she is in grammar school, passing notes and about to be scorched by one of the nuns. Marino has the nerve to slip out a cigarette and begin tapping it on top of his notepad. "This is a non-smoking building, I'm afraid," Dr. Marcus's authoritative voice punctures the silence.
"And it ought to be," Marino says. "Secondary smoke will kill you."
He taps the filtered end of a Marlboro on top of the notepad that bears his secret message about the FBI.
"I'm happy to see the guts man is still around," he adds, referring to the male anatomical model on a stand behind Dr. Marcus, who sits at the head of the table. "Now that's a thousand-yard stare if I ever saw one," Marino says of the guts man,
whose removable plastic organs are present and primly in place. And Scarpetta wonders if he has been used for teaching or explaining injuries to families and attorneys since she was here. Probably not, she decides. Otherwise, Gutsman would be missing organs. She does not know anyone on Dr. Marcus's staff except Assistant Chief Jack Fielding, who so far has avoided eye contact with her and has developed a skin disorder since she saw him last. 5 years have passed, she thinks, and she can scarcely believe what has become of her vain, bodybuilding former forensic pathology partner. Fielding was never supremely useful in administrative matters or necessarily respected for having a searing medical mind, but he was loyal, respectful, and caring during the decade he worked for her. He never tried to undermine her or take her place, and he never came to her defense either when detractors far bolder than he decided to banish her and succeeded. Fielding has lost most of his hair, and his once attractive face is puffy and blotchy, his eyes runny. He sniffs a lot. He would never touch drugs, and she is sure of that, but he looks like a drinker. "Dr. Fielding," she says, staring at him. "Allergies? You didn't used to have them. Perhaps you have a cold," she suggests, although she seriously doubts he has a cold or the flu or any other contagious disease. Possibly he is hungover. Probably he is suffering from a histamine reaction to something, or perhaps to everything. Scarpetta detects the raw edge of a rash peeking out from the V-neck collar of his surgical scrubs, and she follows the white sleeves of his unbuttoned lab coat over the contours of his arms to his raw, scaly hands. Fielding has lost considerable muscle mass. He is almost skinny and is suffering from an allergy or allergies. Dependent personality types are thought to be more susceptible to allergies, diseases, and dermatological complaints, and Fielding isn't thriving. Maybe he shouldn't thrive, and for him to do well without her would seem to confirm that the Commonwealth of Virginia and humankind in general are better off since she was fired and publicly degraded half a decade ago. The small, nasty beast inside her that finds relief in Fielding's misery instantly crawls back into its dark place, and she is stung by upset and concern. She gives Fielding her eyes again. He won't complete the connection. "I hope we'll have a chance to catch up before I leave," she says to him from her green upholstered chair at the foot of the table, as if nobody else is in the room, just Fielding and her, the way it used to be when she was chief
and so well-respected that now and then naive medical students and rookie cops asked for her autograph. She feels Dr. Marcus watching her again, his stare as palpable as thumbtacks driven into her skin. He wears neither lab coat nor any other medical mantle, and she isn't surprised. Like most passionless chiefs who should have left the profession years ago and probably never loved it, he's not the sort to perform autopsies unless there is no one else to do them.
"Let's get started," he announces. "I'm afraid we have a full house this morning, and we have guests, Dr. Scarpetta, and her friend, Captain Marino. Or is it lieutenant or detective? Are you with Los Angeles now?"
"Depends on what's going on," Marino says, his eyes shadowed by the brim of his baseball cap as he fiddles with the unlit cigarette.
"And where are you working now?"
Dr. Marcus reminds him that he has not fully explained himself.
"I'm sorry, I don't recall Dr. Scarpetta mentioning she was bringing you."
He has to remind Scarpetta again, this time before an audience. He is going to take swipes at her in front of everyone. She can see it coming. He will make her pay for confronting him inside his slovenly library, and it occurs to her that Marino made phone calls. Someone he talked to might have alerted Dr. Marcus.
"Oh, of course," he suddenly remembers. "She did mention you work together, I believe."
"Yes," Scarpetta confirms from her lowly spot at the foot of the table.
"So we're going to get through the cases quickly," he informs Scarpetta. "Once again, if you and, I guess I'll just call you Mr. Marino, if the two of you want to get coffee or smoke, as long as it's outside, you're welcome to sit through our staff meeting, but you certainly don't have to."
His words are for the benefit of those not privy to what has already transpired in less than one rude hour, and she detects a warning in his tone. She wanted to intrude, and now she may get an exposure she will find decidedly unpleasant. Dr. Marcus is a politician, and not a good one. Perhaps when he was appointed, those in power had deemed him malleable and harmless, the antithesis of what they thought of her, and maybe they were wrong. He turns to the woman directly on his right, a big horsey woman with a horsey face and closely shorn gray hair. She must be the administrator, and he nods at her to proceed.
"Okay," says the administrator, and everyone looks at the yellow photocopies of today's turndowns, views, and autopsies. "Dr. Ramey, you were on call last night?" she asks.
"Sure was. 'Tis the season," Dr. Ramey replies.
No one laughs. A pall hangs over the conference room. It has nothing to do with the patients down the hall who await the last and most invasive physical examination they'll ever have with any doctor on Earth.
"We have Sissy Shirley, 92-year-old black female from Hanover County, history of heart disease, found dead in bed," Dr. Ramey says, looking at her notes. "She was a resident of an assisted living facility, and she's a view. In fact, I already viewed her. Then we have Benjamin Franklin. That really is his name. 89-year-old black male, also found dead in bed, history of heart disease and nerve failure."
"What?" Dr. Marcus interrupts. "What the hell is nerve failure?"
Several people laugh, and Dr. Ramey's face heats up. She is an overweight, homely young woman, and her face is glowing like a halogen heater on high.
"I don't believe nerve failure is a legitimate cause of death."
Dr. Marcus plays off his deputy chief's acute embarrassment like an actor playing off his captive audience.
"Please don't tell me we brought some poor soul into our clinic because he allegedly died of nerve failure."
His attempt at humor is not meant kindly. Clinics are for the living, and poor souls are people in hard times, not victims of violence or random senseless death. In three words, he has managed to completely deny and mock the reality of people down the hall who are pitifully cold and stiff and zipped inside vinyl and fake fur funeral home pouches, or naked on hard steel gurneys or on hard steel tables, ready for the scalpel and striker saw.
"I'm sorry," Dr. Ramey says with glowing cheeks. "I misread my notes. Renal failure is what I have here. Even I can't read my writing anymore."
"So, oh, Ben Franklin," Marino starts in with a serious face as he plays with a cigarette. "He didn't die of nerve failure after all? Like maybe when he was out there tying a key to his kite string?
Anybody on that list of yours happen to die of lead poisoning, or are we still calling it gunshot wounds?
Dr. Marcus's stare is flat and cold. Dr. Ramey goes on in a monotone.
Mr. Franklin is also a view. I did view him already. We have Finky, Finder.
Not Finky, oh lordy.
Marino keeps up the straight man's charade in that huge voice of his.
You can't find her? I hate it when Finky does that, damn her.
Is that the proper name?
Dr. Marcus's voice has the thin ring of a metal triangle, several octaves higher than Marino's voice. Dr. Ramey's face is so red that Scarpetta worries the tortured woman is going to burst into tears and flee from the room.
The name I was given is what I just stated, Dr. Ramey woodenly replies. 22-year-old black female dead on the toilet, needle still in her arm. Possible heroin OD. That's the second in 4 days in Spotsylvania. This was just handed to me.
She fumbles with a call sheet.
Right before staff meeting, we got a call about a 42-year-old white male named Theodore Whitby, injured while working on a tractor.
Dr. Marcus blinks behind his small, wire-rimmed glasses. Faces blank out.
Don't do it, Scarpetta silently says to Marino.
But he does.
Injured? He asks. He's still alive?
Actually, Dr. Ramey stammers, I didn't take this call. Not personally. Dr. Fielding...
No, I didn't.
Fielding interrupts like a gun hammer clicking back.
You didn't? Oh, Dr. Martin did. This is his note.
Dr. Ramey goes on, her hot and humiliated head bent low over the call sheet.
No one seems to be real clear on what happened, but he was on or near the tractor 1 minute, and then his co-workers suddenly saw him badly injured in the dirt, around 8:30 this morning, not even an hour ago. So somehow he ran over himself, fell off or something, you know, and ran over himself, was dead when the squad got there.
Oh, so he killed himself. A suicide, Marino decides, slowly twirling the cigarette.
Well, it's an irony that this occurred at the old building, the one they're tearing down at 9 North 14th Street,
Dr. Ramey adds tersely. This catches Marino. He drops his not-so-funny act, his silent reaction nudging Scarpetta while she remembers the man in olive green pants and a dark jacket, standing in front of the tractor's back tire on the pavement near the bay door. He was alive then. Now he's dead. He should not have been standing in front of the tire, doing whatever he was doing to the engine. She thought that at the time, and now he's dead.
He's a post, Dr. Ramey says, her composure and authority somewhat restored.
Scarpetta remembers turning the corner as she drove around her old building, and the man and his tractor vanished from sight. He must have gotten his tractor started within minutes of her seeing him, and then he died.
Dr. Fielden, I suggest you do the tractor death, Dr. Marcus says. Make sure he didn't have a heart attack or some other underlying problem before he was run over. The inventory of his injuries is going to be extensive and time-consuming. I don't need to remind you of how thorough we need to be in cases like this. Somewhat ironical, in light of our guest.
He looks at Scarpetta.
A bit before my time, but I believe 9 North 14th Street was your old building.
It was, says she, the ghost from the past, as she recalls Mr. Whitby from a distance in black and olive green, now a ghost too.
I started out in that building.
A bit before your time, she repeats. Then I moved to this one.
She reminds him that she worked in this building too, and then feels slightly foolish for reminding him of a fact that is indisputable. Dr. Ramey continues going through the cases. A prison death that isn't suspicious, but by law, all prison deaths are medical examiner cases. A man found dead in a parking lot, possibly hypothermia. A woman who was a known diabetic died suddenly while climbing out of her car. An unexpected infant death. And a 19-year-old found dead in the middle of a street, possibly a drive-by shooting.
I'm on call for court in Chesterfield, Dr. Ramey concludes. I'm going to need a ride. My car's in the shop again.
I'll drop you off, Marino volunteers, winking at her.
Dr. Ramey looks terrified. Everyone makes moves to get out of their chairs, but Dr. Marcus stops them.
Before you go, he says, I could use your help, and you could probably use a little mental stretching. As you know, the Institute is running another death investigation school, And as usual, I've been prevailed upon to lecture about the medical examiner system. I thought I'd try out a few test cases on the group, especially since we are fortunate enough to have an expert in our midst.
The bastard, Scarpetta thinks. So this is what it's going to be like. The hell with their talk in the library. The hell with his making the office open to her.
He pauses, looking around the table.
A 20-year-old white female, he begins, 7 weeks pregnant. Her boyfriend kicks her in the belly. She calls the police and goes to the hospital. Hours later, she passes the fetus and placenta. The police notify me. What do I do?
No one answers him. It's obvious that they aren't accustomed to his mental stretches and just stare at him.
Come on, come on, he says with a smile. Let's say I just got such a phone call, Dr. Ramey.
Sir? She turns red again.
Come, come. Tell me how to handle it, Dr. Ramey.
Process it like a surgical?
She guesses, as if some alien force has just sucked away her long years of medical training, her very intelligence.
Anybody else? Dr. Marcus asks. Dr. Scarpetta?
He says her name slowly, making sure she notices that he didn't call her Kay.
Ever had a case like this?
I'm afraid so, she replies.
Tell us, what's the legal impact? He asks quite pleasantly.
Obviously, if you beat up a pregnant woman, it's a crime, she answers. On the CME1, I'm going to call the fetal death a homicide.
Interesting.
Dr. Marcus looks around the table as he takes aim at her again.
So, your initial report of investigation would say homicide. Perhaps a bit bold of you? Intent is for the police to determine, not us. Correct?
The sniping son of a bitch, she thinks.
Our job, as mandated by code, is to determine cause and manner of death, she says. As you may recall, in the late 90s, the statute changed after a man shot a woman through the belly and she lived, but her unborn child died. In the scenario you've put before us, Dr. Marcus, I suggest you have the fetus brought in, autopsy it, and give it a case number. There's no place on a yellow-bordered death certificate for manner of death, so you include that with cause, an intrauterine fetal demise due to assault on the mother. Use a yellow-bordered death certificate since the fetus wasn't born alive. Keep a copy with the case file, because a year from now that certificate won't exist anymore, after the Bureau of Vital Records compiles its statistics.
And what do we do with the fetus? Dr. Marcus asks, not quite so pleasantly.
Up to the family.
It's not even 10 centimeters, he says, his voice getting tight again. There's nothing left for the funeral home to bury.
Then fix it in formalin. Give it to the family, whatever they want.
And call it a homicide, he says coldly.
The new statute, she reminds him. In Virginia, an assault with the intent of killing family members born or unborn is a capital crime. Even if you can't prove intent and the charge is malicious wounding of the mother, that carries the same penalty as murder. From there, it tracks down through the system as manslaughter and so on. The point is, there doesn't have to be intent. The fetus doesn't even have to be viable. A violent crime has occurred.
Any debate? Dr. Marcus asks his staff. No comments?
No one responds, not even Fielding.
Then we'll try another one, Dr. Marcus says with an angry smile.
Go ahead, Scarpetta thinks. Go ahead, you insufferable bastard.
A young male in a hospice program, Dr. Marcus begins. He's dying of AIDS. He tells the doctor to pull the plug. If the doctor withdraws life support and the patient dies, is it an ME case or not? Is it a homicide? How about our guest expert again? Did the doctor commit homicide?
It's a natural death unless the doctor put a bullet through the patient's head, Scarpetta answers.
Ah, then you're an advocate of euthanasia.
Informed consent is murky. She doesn't answer his ridiculous charge. The patient is often dealing with depression, and when people are depressed, they can't make informed decisions. This is really a societal question.
Let me clarify what you're saying, Dr. Marcus replies.
Please do.
You have this man in hospice who says, I think I'd like to die today. Should you expect your local doc to do it?
The truth is, the patient in hospice already has that capacity. He can decide to die, she replies. He can have morphine when he wants it for pain, so he asks for more and goes to sleep and dies from an OD. He can wear a do not resuscitate bracelet, and a squad doesn't have to resuscitate him. So he dies. Chances are there will be no consequences to anyone. But is it our case? Dr. Marcus insists, his thin face white with rage as he glares at her. People are in hospices because they want pain control and want to die in peace, she says. People who make informed decisions to wear DNR bracelets basically want the same thing. A morphine OD, a withdrawal of vital support in a hospice, a person wearing a DNR bracelet isn't resuscitated. These are not our issues. If you get called about a case like that, Dr. Marcus, I hope you turn it down. Any comment? Dr. Marcus asks tersely, shuffling paperwork and ready to leave.
Yeah, Marino says to him. You ever thought of writing Q&As for Jeopardy?
Chapter 5. Benton Wesley paces from window to window inside his three-bedroom townhome at the Aspen Club. The signal of his cell phone surges in and out, and Marino's voice is clear, then broken.
What? I'm sorry, say that again.
Benton backs up three steps and stands still.
I said that's not the half of it. A hell of a lot worse than you thought. Marino's voice comes through intact. It's like he brought her in to kick the shit out of her in front of an audience. Or try. I emphasize, try.
Benton stares out at snow caught in crooks of aspen trees and piled on the stubby needles of black spruce. The morning is sunny and clear for the first time in days, and magpies frolic from branch to branch, landing in a flutter and then flitting off in small white bursts of snow. A part of Benton's mind processes the activity and tries to determine a reason, perhaps a biological cause and effect, that might explain the long-tailed bird's gymnastics, as if it matters. His mental probing is as conditioned as the wildlife and as relentless as the gondolas swinging up and down the mountain.
Try. Yes, try.
Benton smiles a little as he imagines it.
But you need to understand, he didn't invite her because it was a choice. It was an order. The health commissioner's behind it. And you know that how? It took me one phone call after she told me she was going. It's too bad about Asp...
Marino's voice fractures. Benton moves to the next window, flames snapping and wood popping in the fireplace at his back. He continues to stare out the floor-to-ceiling glass, his attention fixing on the stone house across the street as the front door opens. A man and a boy emerge dressed for the weather, their breath streaming out in a frozen vapor.
By now she's aware of it, Benton says, aware she's being used.
He knows Scarpetta well enough to make predictions that undoubtedly are true.
I promise she knows the politics, or simply that there are politics. Unfortunately, there's more, a lot more. Can you hear me?
He looks out at the man and the boy shouldering their skis and poles, walking sluggishly in half-buckled ski boots. Benton will not ski or snowshoe today. He doesn't have time.
Huh!
Marino has started saying that a lot of late, and Benton finds it annoying.
Can you hear me?
Benton asks.
Yeah, I'm copying now.
Marino comes back, and Benton can tell he's moving around, roaming for a better signal.
He's trying to blame everything on her, like he brought her here to do that. I don't know what else to tell you until I get into it more. The kid, I mean.
Benton is aware of Jilly Paulson. Her mysterious death may not be national news, not yet, but details from Virginia media sources are on the internet, and Benton has his own ways of accessing information, very confidential information. Jilly Paulson is being used because it is not a requirement to be alive if certain people want to use you.
Did I lose you again? Damn it,
Benton says. And communication would be immensely improved if he could use the landline in his own home. But he can't.
I'm copying you, boss.
Marino's voice is suddenly strong.
Why don't you use your landline? That would solve half our problem, he says, as if reading Benton's thoughts. Can't. You think it's bugged?
Marino isn't joking.
There are ways to detect that. Get Lucy to do it. Thanks for the suggestion.
Benton doesn't need Lucy's help with counter-surveillance, and his concern isn't that his line is bugged. He follows the progress of the man and the boy as he contemplates Jilly Paulson. The boy looks about Jilly's age, the age Jilly was when she died. 13, maybe 14. Only Jilly never got to ski. She never visited Colorado or anywhere else. She was born in Richmond, and that's where she died. And during her short life, mostly, she suffered. Benton notices that the wind is picking up. Snow blowing off trees fills the woods like smoke.
"This is what I want you to tell her,"
Benton says, and his emphasis on the word her indicates he means Scarpetta.
"Her successor, if I must call him that," he says,
and he doesn't want to say Dr. Marcus's name either, or engage in any specifics. And he can't stomach the thought of anyone, least of all this worm, Dr. Joel Marcus, succeeding Scarpetta.
"This person is of interest,"
Benton continues, talking cryptically.
"When she gets here," he adds, referring to Scarpetta again, "I'll go over all of it in person with her. But for now, use caution, extreme caution." "What do you mean, when she gets here? I'm assuming she might be stuck here for a while." "She needs to call me."
"Extreme caution?" Marino complains. "Shit, you would have to say something like that."
"While she's there, you stay with her."
"Huh.
Stay with her, am I clear?"
"She won't like it," Marino says.
Benton looks out at the harsh slopes of the snow-laced Rockies, at a beauty shaped by cruel scouring winds and the brute force of glaciers. Aspens and evergreens are a stubble on the faces of mountains that surround this old mining town like a bowl. And to the east, beyond a ridge, a distant gray shroud of clouds is slowly spreading across the intense blue sky. Later today, it will snow again.
"No, she never does,"
Benton says.
"She said you got a case."
"Yes."
Benton can't discuss it.
"Well, it's too bad being an Aspen and all, and you got a case, and now she does, so you'll just stay there and work your case, I guess."
"For now, I will," Benton says.
"Must be something serious if you're on it during your vacation in Aspen,"
Marino fishes.
"I can't get into it."
"Huh. These damn phones," Marino says. "Lucy ought to invent something that can't be tapped into or picked up on a scanner. She could make a fortune."
"I believe she's already made a fortune. Maybe several fortunes."
"No kidding."
"Take care,"
Benton says.
"If I don't talk to you in the next few days, take care of her. Watch your back and hers. I mean it."
"Tell me something I don't already do," Marino says. "Don't hurt yourself out there playing in the snow."
Benton ends the call and returns to a couch that faces the windows near the fire. On the wormy chestnut coffee table is a legal pad filled with his almost indecipherable scrawl, and near that is a Glock 40 caliber pistol. Slipping a pair of reading glasses out of the breast pocket of his denim shirt, he settles against the armrest and begins flipping through the legal pad. Each lined page is numbered, and in the upper right-hand corner is a date. Benton rubs his angular jaw, remembering that he hasn't shaved in 2 days. And his rough, graying beard reminds him of the bristly trees on the mountains. He circles the words "shared paranoia" and tilts his head up as he peers through the reading glasses on the tip of his straight, sharp nose. In the margin, he scribbles, "will seem to work when fills in gaps, serious gaps, can't last. L is real victim, not H. H is narcissist." And he underlines narcissist 3 times. He jots histrionic and underlines it twice. And he turns to a different page, this one with the heading "Post-Offense Behavior." And he listens for the sound of running water, puzzled that he hasn't heard it yet. Critical mass will reach no later than Christmas. Tension unbearable. Will kill by Christmas, if not sooner, he writes, quietly looking up as he senses her before he hears her.
"Who is that?" asks Henry, which is short for Henrietta.
She stands on the stairway landing, her delicate hand resting on the railing. Henry Walden stares across the living room at him.
"Good morning,"
Benton says.
"You usually take a shower."
"There's coffee." Henry pulls a plain red flannel robe more tightly around her thin body. her green eyes sleepy and reticent, as she takes in Benton, studying him, as if a pre-existing argument or encounter stands between them. She is 28 and attractive in an off-tilt way. Her features aren't perfect, because her nose is strong and, according to her own warped beliefs, too big. Her teeth aren't perfect either. But right now, nothing would convince her that she has a beautiful smile, that she is disturbingly alluring even when she doesn't try to be. Benton hasn't tried to convince her, and won't. It is too dangerous.
I heard you talking to someone, she says. Was it Lucy?
No, he replies.
Oh,
she says, and disappointment tugs her lips, and anger flashes in her eyes.
Oh, well, who was it then?
It was a private conversation, Henry.
He takes off his reading glasses.
We've talked a lot about boundaries. We've talked about them every day, haven't we?
I know, she says from the landing, her hand on the railing. If it wasn't Lucy, who was it? Was it her aunt? She talks too much about her aunt.
Her aunt doesn't know you're here, Henry,
Benton says very patiently.
Only Lucy and Rudy know you're here.
I know about you and her aunt.
Only Lucy and Rudy know you're here,
he repeats.
It was Rudy, then. What did he want? I always knew he liked me.
She smiles, and the look on her face is peculiar and unsettling.
Rudy is gorgeous. I should have gotten with him. I could have. When we were out in the Ferrari, I could have. I could have with anybody when I was in the Ferrari. Not that I need Lucy to have a Ferrari.
Boundaries, Henry, Benton says.
And he refuses to accept the abysmal defeat that is a dark plain in front of him. Nothing but darkness that has spread wider and deeper ever since Lucy flew Henry to Aspen and entrusted her to him.
You won't hurt her, Lucy said to him at the time. Someone else will hurt her, take advantage of her, and find out things about me and what I do.
I'm not a psychiatrist,
Benton said.
She needs a post-incident stress counselor, a forensic psychologist. That's what you do. You can do it. You can find out what happened. We have to know what happened,
Lucy said, and she was beside herself. Lucy never panics, but she was panicking. She believes Benton can figure out anyone. Even if he could, that doesn't mean all people can be fixed. Henry is not a hostage. She could leave any time. It profoundly unsettles him that she seems to have no interest in leaving, that she just might be enjoying herself. Benton has figured out a lot in the 4 days he has spent with Henry Walden. She is a character disorder, and was a character disorder before the attempted murder. If it wasn't for the scene photographs and the fact that someone really was inside Lucy's house, Benton might believe there was no attempted murder. He worries that Henry's personality now is simply an exaggeration of what it was before the assault, and that realization is extremely disturbing to him, and he can't imagine what Lucy was thinking when she met Henry. Lucy wasn't thinking, he decides. That's the likely answer.
Did Lucy let you drive her Ferrari?
He asks.
Not the black one.
What about the silver one, Henry?
It's not silver. It's California blue. I drove it whenever I wanted.
She looks at him from the landing, her hand on the railing, her long hair messy, and her eyes sultry with sleep, as if she is posing for a sexy photo shoot.
You drove it by yourself, Henry.
He wants to make sure. A very important missing piece is how the perpetrator found Henry. And Benton does not believe the attack was random, the luck of the draw, a pretty young woman in the wrong mansion or in the wrong Ferrari at the wrong time.
I told you I did, Henry says, her face pale and lacking in expression.
Only her eyes are alive, and the energy in them is volatile and unsettling.
But she's selfish with the black one.
When was the last time you drove the California blue Ferrari?
Benton asks in the same mild, steady voice. And he has learned to get information when he can. It doesn't matter if Henry is sitting or walking or standing on the other side of the room with her hand on the railing. If something comes up, he tries to dislodge it from her before it is out of sight again. No matter what happened or happens to her, Benton wants to know who went inside Lucy's house and why. The hell with Henry, he is tempted to think. What he really cares about is Lucy. I'm something in that car, Henry replies, her eyes bright and cold in her expressionless face.
And you drove it often, Henry?
Whenever I want it. She stares at him.
Every day to the training camp?
Whenever I damn well want it.
Her impassive pale face stares at him, and anger shines in her eyes.
Can you remember the last time you drove it? When was that, Henry?
I don't know. Before I got sick.
Before you got the flu, and that was when, about 2 weeks ago?
I don't know.
She has become resistant, and will not say anything else about the Ferrari right now. And he doesn't push her, because her denials and avoidance have their own truths to tell. Benton is quite adept at interpreting what isn't said, and she has just indicated that she drove the Ferrari whenever she pleased and was aware of the attention she attracted, and enjoyed it, because she has to be the eye of the storm. Even on her best days, Henry has to be the center of chaos and the creator of chaos, the star of her own crazy drama. And for this reason alone, most police and forensic psychologists would conclude that she faked her own attempted murder and staged the crime scene, that the attack never happened. But it did. That's the irony. This bizarre, dangerous drama is real. And he worries about Lucy. He has always worried about Lucy, but now he is really worried.
Who are you talking to on the phone?
Henry gets back to that.
Rudy misses me. I should have gotten with him. I wasted so much time down there.
Let's start the day with a reminder of our boundaries, Henry.
Benton patiently says the same thing he said yesterday morning, and the morning before that, when he was making notes on the couch.
Okay,
she replies from the landing.
Rudy called. That's who it was, she says.
Chapter 6. Water drums in sinks, and X-rays are illuminated on every light box as Scarpetta leans close to a gash that almost severed the dead tractor driver's nose from his face. I do a stat alcohol and CO on him, she says to Dr. Jack Fielding, who is on the other side of the stainless steel gurney, the body between them.
You noticing something? He asks.
I don't smell alcohol, and he's not cherry pink, but just to be on the safe side.
I'm telling you, cases like this are trouble, Jack.
The dead man is still clothed in his olive-green work pants, which are dusted with red clay and ripped open at the thighs. Fat and muscle and shattered bones protrude from split skin. The tractor ran over the middle of his body, but not while she was watching. It could have happened 1 minute, maybe 5 minutes after she turned the corner. And she is certain that the man she saw was Mr. Whitby. She tries not to envision him alive, but every other minute he is there in her mind, standing in front of the huge tractor tire, poking at the engine, doing something to the engine.
Hey,
Fielding calls out to a young man whose head is shaved, probably a soldier from Fort Lee's Graves Registration Unit.
What's your name?
Bailey, sir.
Scarpetta picks out several other young men and women in scrubs, shoe and hair covers, face masks and gloves, who are probably interns from the army and here to learn how to handle dead bodies. She wonders if they are destined for Iraq. She sees the olive green of the army, and it is the same olive green of Mr. Whitby's ripped work pants.
Do the funeral home a favor, Bailey, and tie off the carotid, Fielding says gruffly.
And when he worked for Scarpetta, he wasn't so unpleasant. He didn't boss people around and loudly find fault with them. The soldier is embarrassed, his muscular tattooed right arm frozen mid-air, his gloved fingers around a long, crooked surgical needle threaded with No. 7 cotton twine. He is helping a morgue assistant suture up the Y incision of an autopsy that was begun prior to staff meeting, and it is the morgue assistant and not the soldier who should know about tying off the carotid. Scarpetta feels sorry for the soldier. And if Fielding still worked for her, she would have had a word with him, and he would not treat anyone rudely in her morgue.
Yes, sir,
the soldier says with a stricken look on his young face.
Just getting ready to do that, sir.
Really?
Fielding asks, and everyone in the morgue can hear what he is saying to the poor young soldier.
You know why you tie off the carotid?
No, sir.
It's polite, that's why,
Fielding says.
You tie string around a major blood vessel such as a carotid so funeral home embalmers don't have to dig around for it. It's a polite thing to do, Bailey.
Yes, sir.
Jesus, Fielding says.
I put up with this every day because he lets everyone and their brother in here. You see him in here?
He resumes making notes on his clipboard.
Hell no. He's been here almost 4 damn months and hasn't done one autopsy. Oh, and in case you haven't figured it out, he likes to make people wait. His favorite thing. Obviously nobody gave you the rundown on him. Excuse the pun.
He indicates the dead man between them who managed to run himself down with a tractor.
If you called me, I'd have told you not to bother coming here.
I should have called you, she says, watching 5 people struggle to roll an enormous woman off a gurney onto a stainless steel table. Bloody fluid trickles from her nose and mouth. She's got a huge panniculus. Scarpetta refers to the fold or drape of fat that people as obese as the dead woman have over their bellies. And what Scarpetta is really saying to Fielding is that she won't engage in comments about Dr. Marcus when she is standing in his morgue and surrounded by his staff.
Well, it's my fucking case, Fielding says.
And now he is talking about Dr. Marcus and Jilly Paulson.
The asshole never even stepped foot in the morgue when her body came in, for Christ's sake. And everyone knew the case was going to cause a stink. His first big stink. Oh, don't give me one of your looks, Dr. Scarpetta.
He never could stop calling her that, even though she encouraged him to call her Kay, because they respected each other, and she considered him a friend. But he wouldn't call her Kay when he worked for her, and he still won't.
No one here is listening, not that I give a damn. You got dinner plans?
With you, I hope. She helps him remove Mr. Whitby's muddy leather work boots, untying the filthy laces and pulling out the dirty cowhide tongues. Rigor mortis is in the very early stages, and he is still limber and warm.
How the hell did these guys run over themselves? Can you tell me that?
Fielding says.
I never can figure it out. Good. My house at 7. I still live in the same place.
I'll tell you how they often do it, she says, as she remembers Mr. Whitby standing in front of the tractor tire, doing something to the engine. They're having some sort of mechanical problem, and get off the seat, and stand right in front of that huge back tire, and fool with the starter, possibly trying to jump it with a screwdriver, forgetting the tractor's in gear. It's their bad luck, it starts. In his case, running him over midsection. She points at the dirty tire tread pattern on Mr. Whitby's olive work pants and his black vinyl jacket that is embroidered with his name, T. Whitby, in thick red thread. When I saw him, he was standing in front of the tire.
Yeah, our old building. Welcome back to town.
Was he found under the tire?
Went right over him and kept going.
Fielding pulls off mud-stained socks that have left the impression of their weave on the man's large white feet.
Remember that big yellow-painted metal pole sticking up from the pavement near the back door? The tractor ran into it, and that's what stopped it. Otherwise, it might have busted right through the bay door. I guess it wouldn't matter, since they're tearing the place down.
Then he's not likely to be an asphyxia. A diffuse crush injury the width of that tire, she says, looking at the body. Exsanguination. Expect an abdominal cavity full of blood, ruptured spleen, liver, bladder, bowels, crushed pelvis, my guess. 7 o'clock it is.
What about your sidekick?
Don't call him that. You know better.
He's invited. He looks pretty goofy in that LAPD cap.
I warned him.
What do you think cut his face? Something underneath or in back of the tractor?
Fielding asks. And blood trickles down the side of Mr. Whitby's stubbly face as Fielding touches the partially severed nose. It may not be a cut. As the tire progressed over his body, it pulled his skin with it. This injury, she points at the deep, jagged wound over his cheeks and the bridge of his nose, may be a tear, not a cut. If it's really an issue, you should be able to see rust or grease under the scope, and significant tissue bridging from the shearing effect as opposed to cutting. One thing I would do if I were you is answer all questions.
Oh, yeah.
Fielding glances up from his clipboard, from the clothing and personal effects form he is filling out with a ballpoint pen tied to the steel clamp. A very good chance this man's family is going to want relief for their suffering, she says. Death at the workplace. A notorious workplace.
Oh, yeah. Of all places to die.
Fielding's latex-gloved fingers are stained red as he touches the wound on the man's face, and warm blood drips freely as he manipulates the nearly severed nose. He flips up a page on the clipboard and begins to draw the injury on a body diagram. He leans close to the face, peering intensely through plastic safety glasses.
Don't see any rust or grease, he says, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
Good idea. She agrees with the direction of his thoughts.
I'd swab it, get the labs to check it out, check everything. I wouldn't be surprised if someone says this man was run over or pushed off the tractor or in front of it or was slammed in the face with a shovel first. You never know.
Oh, yeah. Money, money, money.
Not just money, she replies. Lawyers make it all about money. But at first, it's all about shock, pain, loss, about its being somebody else's fault. No family member wants to believe this was a stupid death, that it was preventable, that any experienced tractor driver knows better than to stand in front of a back tire and fool with a starter, bypassing the default safety of a normal ignition, which allows the tractor to start only in neutral, not in gear. But what do people do? They get too comfortable, or in a hurry, and don't think. And it's human nature to deny the probability that someone we care about caused his or her own death, intentionally or inadvertently. But you've heard my lectures before. When Fielding was starting out, he was one of her forensic fellows. She taught him forensic pathology. She taught him how to perform not just competent but meticulous and aggressive medico-legal scene investigations and autopsies. And it saddens her to remember how unabashedly eager he was to work across the table from her and take it all in, to go with her to court when time allowed and listen to her testify, to sit down in her office and go over his reports, to learn. Now he is worn out and has a skin condition, and she is fired, and both of them are here. I should have called you, she says, and she unbuckles Mr. Whitby's cheap leather belt and unbuttons and unzips his torn olive pants. We'll work on Jillie Paulson and figure her out.
Oh, yeah, Fielding says.
And he didn't used to say, oh, yeah, so often either. Chapter 7 Henry Walden wears fleece-lined suede slippers that make no sound on the carpet as she drifts like a black apparition toward the tan leather wing chair across from the couch. I took my shower, she says, perching on the chair and drawing her slender legs under her. Benton catches a deliberate flash of young flesh, the pale recesses of high inner thighs. He does not look or react the way most men would.
Why do you care?
She asks him, and she has asked him this every morning since she got here.
It makes you feel better, doesn't it, Henry?
She nods, staring at him like a cobra.
Little things are important. Eating, sleeping, being clean, exercise, regaining control.
I heard you talking to someone, she says.
That's a problem, he replies,
his eyes steady on hers over the rim of his glasses, the legal pad in his lap as before. But there are more words on it. The words Black Ferrari and without permission and was followed from the camp likely and point of contact, the Black Ferrari. He says,
Private conversations are supposed to be just that, private. So we need to go back to our original agreement, Henry. Do you remember what it was?
She pulls off her slippers and drops them on the carpet. Her delicate bare feet are on the chair cushion, and when she bends over to study them, the red robe falls open slightly.
No.
Her voice is barely audible, and she shakes her head.
I know you remember, Henry.
Benton repeats her name often, to remind her who she is, to personalize what has been depersonalized, and in some regards irrevocably damaged.
Our agreement was respect, remember?
She bends more deeply and picks at an unpainted toenail, her stare fixed on what she is doing, her nakedness beneath her robe offered to him.
Part of having respect is allowing each other privacy and modesty, he says quietly. We've talked about boundaries a lot. Violating modesty is a violation of boundaries.
Her free hand crawls up to her chest and gathers the robe together while she continues to study and manipulate her toes.
I just woke up, she says, as if this explains her exhibitionism.
Thank you, Henry.
It is important for her to believe that Benton does not want her sexually, not even in his fantasies.
But you didn't just get up. You got up, came in, and we talked, and then you took a shower.
My name isn't Henry, she says.
What would you like me to call you?
Nothing.
You have two names, he says. You have the name you were christened at birth, and the name you used in your acting career and still use.
Well,
I'm Henry, then,
she says, looking down at her toes.
So I'll call you Henry.
She nods, looking at her toes.
What do you call her?
Benta knows who she means, but he doesn't answer.
You sleep with her. Lucy's told me all about it.
She emphasizes the word all. Benton feels a flash of anger, but he doesn't show it. Lucy would not have told Henry all about his relationship with Scarpetta. No, he reminds himself. This is Henry goading him again, testing his boundaries again. No, crashing through his boundaries again.
How come she's not here with you? Henry asks. It's your vacation, isn't it? And she's not here. A lot of people don't have sex after a while. That's one reason I don't want to be with anyone, not for long. No sex. Usually after 6 months, people stop having sex. She's not here because I am.
Henry stares at him.
That's correct, he replies. She's not here because you are, Henry.
She must have been mad when you told her she couldn't come.
She understands, he says.
But now he isn't being entirely honest. Scarpetta understood, and she didn't.
You can't come to Aspen right now, he told her after he got Lucy's panicked phone call. I'm afraid a case has come up, and I have to deal with it.
You're leaving Aspen, then, Scarpetta said.
I can't talk about the case, he replied.
And for all he knows, she thinks he is anywhere but in Aspen right now. This really isn't fair, Benton, she said. I set aside these 2 weeks for us. I have cases, too.
Please bear with me, he replied. I promise I'll explain later.
Of all times, she said, this is a very bad time. We need it this time. They do need this time, and instead he is here with Henry.
Tell me about your dreams last night. Do you remember them?
He is saying to Henry. Her nimble fingers fondle her left big toe as if it is sore. She frowns. Benton gets up. Casually, he picks up the Glock and walks across the living room to the kitchen. Opening a cupboard, he places the pistol on a top shelf and pulls out 2 cups and pours coffee. He and Henry drink it black.
Maybe a little strong. I can make more.
And he sets her cup on an end table and returns to his place on the couch.
Night before last, you dreamed about a monster. Actually, you called it the Beast, didn't you?
His keen eyes find her unhappy ones.
Did you see the Beast again last night?
She doesn't answer him, and her mood is dramatically altered from what it was earlier this morning. Something happened in the shower, but he'll get to that later.
We don't have to talk about the Beast if you don't want to, Henry. But the more you tell me about him, the more likely I am to find him. You want me to find him, don't you?
Who are you talking to?
She asks in the same hushed, childlike voice. But she is not a child. She is anything but innocent.
You are talking about me,
she persists as the sash of her robe loosens and more flesh shows.
I promise I wasn't talking about you. No one knows you're here. No one but Lucy and Rudy. I believe you trust me, Henry.
He pauses, looking at her.
I believe you trust Lucy.
Her eyes get angry at the mention of Lucy's name.
I believe you trust us, Henry,
Benton says, sitting calmly, his legs crossed, his fingers laced and in his lap.
I would like you to cover yourself, Henry.
She rearranges her robe, tucking it between her legs and tightening the sash. Benton knows exactly what her naked body looks like, but he does not imagine it. He has seen photographs, and he will not look at them again unless it is necessary to review them with other professionals and eventually with her when she is ready. Or if she is ready. For now, she represses the facts of the case either unwillingly or willingly, and acts out in ways that would seduce and infuriate weaker human beings who neither care about nor understand her ploys. Her relentless attempts to sexually arouse Benton are not simply about transference, but are a direct manifestation of her acute and chronic narcissistic needs and her desire to control and dominate, degrade and destroy anyone who dares to care about her. Henry's every action and reaction are about self-hate and rage.
Why did Lucy send me away? She asks.
Can you tell me? Why don't you tell me why you're here?
Because...
She wipes her eyes on the sleeve of her robe.
The Beast,
Benton's eyes are steady on her from his safe position on the couch, the words on the legal pad unreadable from where she sits and well beyond her reach. He does not encourage her conversation. It is important that he be patient, incredibly patient, like a hunter in the woods who stands perfectly still and barely breathes.
It came into the house. I don't remember.
Benton watches her in silence.
Lucy led it into the house, she says.
Benton will not push her, but he will not allow misinformation or outright lies.
No, Lucy did not let it into the house, Benton corrects her. No one let it into the house. It came in because the back door was unlocked and the alarm was off. We've talked about this. Do you remember why the door was unlocked and the alarm was off?
She stares at her toes, her hands still.
We've talked about why, he says.
I had the flu, she replies, staring at a different toe. I was sick and she wasn't home. I was shivering and went out in the sun, and I forgot to lock the door and reset the alarm. I had a fever and forgot. Lucy blames me.
He sips his coffee. Already it has gotten cold. Coffee doesn't stay hot in the mountains of Aspen, Colorado.
Has Lucy said it's your fault?
She thinks it.
Henry is staring past him now, out the windows behind his head.
She thinks everything is my fault.
She never told me she thinks it's your fault, he says.
You were telling me about your dreams. He goes back to that.
The dreams you had last night.
She blinks and rubs her big toe again.
Is it hurting?
She nods.
I'm sorry. Would you like something for it?
She shakes her head.
Nothing would help.
She isn't talking about her right big toe, but is making the connection between its having been broken and her now finding herself in his protective care more than 1,000 miles from Pompano Beach, Florida, where she almost died. Henry's eyes heat up.
I was walking on a trail, she says. There were rocks on one side, this sheer wall of rocks very close to the trail. There were cracks, this crack between the rocks. And I don't know why I did it, but I wedged myself into it and got stuck.
Her breath catches, and she shoves blonde hair out of her eyes, and her hand shakes.
I was wedged between rocks. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't get free, and nobody could get me out. When I was in the shower, I remembered my dream. The water was hitting my face, and when I held my breath, I remembered my dream.
Did someone try to get you out?
Benton doesn't react to her terror or pass judgment on whether it is real or false. He doesn't know which it is. With her, there is so little he knows. She is motionless in her chair, struggling for breath.
You said nobody could get you out,
Benton goes on, calmly, quietly, in the unprovocative tone of the counselor he has become for her.
Was another person there, or other people?
I don't know.
He waits. If she continues to struggle for breath, he will have to do something about it. But for now, he is patient, the hunter waiting.
I can't remember. I don't know why, but for a minute I thought someone... It occurred to me in my dream, maybe, that someone could chip away at the rocks, maybe with a pickaxe. And then I thought, no, the rock is way too hard. You can't get me out. No one can. I'm going to die. I was going to die, I knew it, and then I couldn't take it anymore, so the dream stopped.
Her rambling rendition stops as abruptly as the dream apparently did. Henry takes a deep breath, and her body relaxes. Her eyes focus on Benton.
It was awful, she says.
Yes, he says. It must have been awful. I can't think of anything more frightening than not being able to breathe.
She flattens her hand against her heart.
My chest couldn't move. I was breathing very shallowly, you know? And then I just didn't have the strength.
No one would be strong enough to move the rocky face of a mountain, he replies.
I couldn't get air.
Her assailant may have tried to smother or asphyxiate her, and Benton envisions the photographs. One by one, he holds up the photographs in his mind and examines Henry's injuries, trying to make sense of what she has just said. He sees blood trickling from her nose and smeared across her cheeks and staining the sheet beneath her head as she lies on her belly on the bed. Her body is naked and uncovered, her arms stretched out above her head and palms down on the bed, her legs bent, one more bent than the other.
Fenton examines another photograph, focusing on it in his memory as Henry gets up from her chair. She mutters that she wants more coffee and will get it herself. Fenton processes what she says and the fact that his pistol is in the kitchen cabinet, but she doesn't know which cabinet, because her back was to him when he tucked the pistol out of sight. He watches her, reading what she is doing in the moment, while he reads the hieroglyphics of the injuries, the peculiar marks on her body. The tops of her hands were red because he, or she, and Benton will not assume the gender of her assailant, bruised her. She had fresh contusions on the tops of her hands, and she had several reddish areas of contusion on her upper back. Over the next few days, the redness from subcutaneous broken blood vessels darkened to a stormy purple. Benton watches Henry pour more coffee. He thinks about the photographs of her unconscious body in situ. The fact that her body is beautiful is of no importance beyond Benton's consideration that all details of her appearance and behavior may have been violent triggers to the person who tried to murder her. Henry is thin, but most assuredly not androgynous. She has breasts and pubic hair and would not appeal to a pedophile. At the time of the assault, she was sexually active. He watches her return to the leather chair, both hands cupping the mug of coffee. It doesn't bother him that she is inconsiderate. A polite person would have asked if he would like more coffee, too. But Henry is probably one of the most selfish, insensitive people Benton has ever met, and was selfish and insensitive before the attack, and will always be selfish and insensitive. It would be a good thing if she were never around Lucy again. But he has no right to wish that or make it happen, he tells himself.
Henry, Benton says, getting up for more coffee. Are you up for doing a fact check this morning?
Yes, but I can't remember.
Her voice follows him into the kitchen.
I know you don't believe me.
Why do you think that?
He pours more coffee and returns to the living room.
The doctor didn't.
Oh yes, the doctor. He said he didn't believe you,
Benton says as he sits back down on the couch.
I think you know my opinion of that, Doctor, but I'll express it again. He thinks women are hysterical and doesn't like them. Certainly he has no respect for them. And that's because he is afraid of them. He's also an ER doctor, and he knows nothing about violent offenders or victims.
He thinks I did this to myself, Henry replies angrily. He thinks I didn't hear what he said to the nurse.
Benton is careful how he reacts. Henry is offering new information. He can only hope that it is true.
Tell me, he says. I would very much like to know what he said to the nurse.
I should sue the asshole, she adds.
Benton waits, sipping his coffee.
Maybe I will sue him, she adds spitefully. He thought I didn't hear him because I had my eyes shut when he walked into the room. I was lying there half asleep, and the nurse was in the doorway, and then he showed up, so I pretended I was out of it.
Pretended you were asleep, Benton says.
She nods.
You're a trained actor. You used to be a professional actor.
I still am. You don't just stop being an actor. I'm just not in any productions right now because I have other things to do.
You've always been good at acting, I would imagine, he says.
Yes.
At pretending. You've always been good at pretending.
He pauses.
Do you pretend things often, Henry?
Her eyes get hard as she looks at him.
I was pretending in the hospital room so I could hear the doctor. I heard every word. He said, "Nothing like being raped if you're mad at someone. Payback's hell." And he laughed.
I don't blame you for wanting to sue him, Benton says. This was in the ER?
No, in my room. Later that day when they moved me to one of the floors after all the tests. I don't remember which floor.
That's even worse, Benton says. He shouldn't have come to your room at all. He's an ER doctor and isn't assigned to one of the floors. He stopped by because he was curious, and that's not right.
I'm going to sue him. I hate his guts.
She rubs her toe again, and her bruised toe and the bruises on her hands have faded to a nicotine yellow.
He made some comment about dextra heads. I don't know what that is, but he was insulting me, making fun of me.
Again, this is new information, and Benton feels renewed hope that with time and patience, she will remember more or be more truthful.
A dextrohead is someone who abuses allergy and flu remedies or cough syrups that have opiates. It's popular among teenagers, unfortunately.
The asshole, she mutters, picking at her robe. Can't you do something to get him into trouble?
Henry, do you have any idea why he indicated you were raped? Benton asks.
I don't know. I don't think I was.
Do you remember the forensic nurse?
She slowly shakes her head, no.
You were wheeled into an examination room near the ER, and a physical evidence recovery kit was used. You know what that is, don't you? When you got tired of acting, you were a police officer before Lucy met you in L.A. this fall, just a few months ago, and hired you. So you know about swabs and collecting hair and fibers and all the rest.
I didn't get tired of it. I just wanted time off from it to do something else.
Okay, but you remember the perk?
She nods.
And the nurse? She was very nice, I'm told. Her name is Brenda. She examined you for sexual assault injury and evidence. The room is also used for children. It was filled with stuffed animals. The wallpaper was Winnie the Pooh, bears, honeypots, trees. Brenda wasn't wearing a nurse's uniform. She had on a light blue suit.
You weren't there,
she told me over the phone.
Henry stares at her bare feet, which are up on the chair cushion.
You asked her what she had on?
She's got hazel eyes, short black hair.
Benton tries to dislodge what Henry is repressing or pretends to be repressing, and it is time to discuss the physical evidence recovery kit.
There was no seminal fluid, Henry. No evidence of sexual assault. But Brenda found fibers adhering to your skin. It appears you had on some sort of lotion or body oil. Do you remember if you put on lotion or body oil that morning?
No,
she quietly replies.
But I can't say I didn't.
End of Disc 2.